Okay. Amnesty International and others had put that up. And I reported that we got sued. Barrick Gold. They wanted me to sign a statement that they're going to sue us into oblivion unless I sign a statement saying that I happily confirm, and my newspaper can, this quote, happily confirm, that no one died in the peaceful clearance of the mine. And I'd say, well, nothing would, I would be very happy to confirm that if you give me some evidence. They said, the evidence is that we're billionaires, we've got a mean law firm, and you're going to sign it. I said, well, I like a little better, more evidence than that. Let's get an independent human rights expert. Let's get someone. There's a guy, and I want you to remember his name, Tundu Lissu, L-I-S-S-U. Okay, he's a human rights attorney, internationally renowned, works at the World Resources Institute in Washington. Decided to send him to Tanzania, flew him there to get the evidence and confirm people did die, didn't die, or whatever. Relied. He sent back to me email with an attached photo. And I also have this, unfortunately, in color, which is, if you look at it, it's a corpse with its head crushed in and hands severed off from apparently from a bulldozer. He brought back signed and sworn witness statements, and including a videotape of the bodies being exhumed from the police files. So I sent that to Barrick, and Barrick got that, and my paper got that, and I said, okay, now what do you want to do? I'm happy, you know, give me an explanation. In other words, if you have, they started the explanations, oh, it's wrong, this is extortion, or that's not really from that, you know, they had reasons. I said, fine, I'll run, now that you have this material, I won't run, I'll run your side of the story. No. You will happily confirm. I said, well, I can't. I said, and I was about to, because my paper is saying, and a lot of investigative reporters have written saying, you know, it's not America. There is no First Amendment. And this is just how it is. So just it cost a fortune to defend this thing. So, you know, just sign off. But there was a little problem in that Tundu Lissu, the investigator, was charged with sedition in Tanzania for sending out the evidence, for obtaining evidence out of police files. His law partners were beat up. Opposition members were arrested, disappeared. Tanzania. So if I signed that document, they would use that against him. So I said, I can't sign. And human rights groups, by the way, and I want to thank Friends of the Earth, I don't want to thank Amnesty International, which withdrew the accusations after they got the evidence. Then Friends of the Earth, group called Corner House, Bianca Jagger, by the way, came and jumped on and seen others, and went to the courts and said, you can't allow a lie to stand and say and cover up what is apparent genocide. And the courts said, no, we can't, we won't allow them. Believe it or not, they said it was extraordinary in British jurisprudence history. We won't allow this company, or even if the paper agrees, we're not going to allow the judge that you can't say that people didn't die. Okay? And now, Tundu got out, we got him out of Washington, but he said he's going back. He went back. Because even though I said not to, his wife said not to, I said, they're going to arrest you. He said, I'll be lucky if I get arrested, but I have to finish this, bring out the truth. And so we have been, I gave you his name because we're running an international campaign to make sure that he is released or not charged, that the charges are dropped, and that we try to save his life. And that campaign has been headed by Congresswoman Cynthia Kenney. Oh, there's more on that. Actually, you know, it's very interesting. I had a, I almost got some of that. You saw that on television, CNN? No? Almost, because I was going to be on CNN television. Jim Wolfensohn, the president of the World Bank, got on CNN There's going to be a G7 meeting before the last G7 meeting, but he just got on CNN to say how wonderful globalization was, you know, just the wonders of globalization, the wonders of his organization, that the World Bank, which is the development bank, and they help all the little tiny brown people develop. And globalization is wonderful. You all get cell phones for the Bolivians, right? Okay, fine. CNN asked me to come on and either respond, question what Wolfson was saying, whatever. And I wanted to, because one of the things I wanted to ask about is that they are a development bank and the biggest single development loan guarantee in the World Bank's history. So there was granted for gold mining Tanzania to Barrick Gold Mining. So I had a couple of questions for Mr. Wolfenson. But not only that, but I had questions for him about something else too, because where is it here? I had some documents. It's unusual. Some documents somehow grew legs, crawled out of his file cabinet, and landed on my desk. Sat down, and there they were. Hundreds, about 3,000 pages of internal documents from the World Bank, and then I also got some from the IMF and the WTO, which just happened to arrive on my desk. And this one says, it's very funny, it says, I don't know if it's something, it says that this document has restricted distribution and may be used only by recipients in the performance of their official duties. So I received my official, I'm an investigative reporter, my official duty is to show it to you, right? Yeah. And you'll get some of this, a lot of this in the book, including copies of this stuff. I'm going to try to get more on my website, www.gregpalace.com, which I you got to go to. And this is about Argentina, actually. It's called Country Assistance Plan. Country Assistance Plan said, why is that secret? You'd think that, man, they're assisting a country that they want to, like, jump up and shout, we're assisting Argentina, they're in real trouble, aren't they? And in fact, it even has one of the pages, this is just a page, but I have, it's like about 70 pages, the document. And there's a section called Helping the Poor and Unemployed. I say, right on. And under Helping the Poor and Unemployed, it's secretly requiring Argentina to drop its unemployment payments by 20%. Okay. It's a little tiny rule that if something is secret, you want to see it, because see, they don't hide good things. You know, they don't say, oh, we're really doing something wonderful for Argentina, but keep it a secret for Christmas or something. So I wanted to ask Jim about the assistance to Argentina, and I wanted to ask him maybe about the Barrick mine or bring these things up. And almost, Wolfenson and the World Bank told CNN, if Greg Palast is put on the air, not only won't Wolfenson appear, he will not let CNN use the footage of an interview they've already taped. And CNN did the courageous thing and yanked me off the air. Okay. And your news isn't censored. But one of the things, I just have to, because I was looking at this thing, Arthur Anderson was just, you know, convicted. And the Bush administration, is shocked. Big donors like that, how dare they get caught. indicted for helping Bush's largest donor cook the books of this big, giant international power company, Enron. And they're shocked. This has never happened before. And I'm reading these long tomes in the wonderful New York Times and Washington Post about what it means. This whole thing of the new, today was this report in the Seattle Times about the new kind of new corruption in business, you know, Forbes, this kind of new wave of corruption that seems to be happening. So new is kind of interesting to me because I don't know why. And this report I got, this is a document I got 13 years ago. It's from a power company. With Enron, there were half a dozen other companies, if you read the book called, what I call the Power Pirates, who who clipped the state of California for, according to the investigators from California, whom I've been working with. I got a book coming out, by the way, from the United Nations on the technical aspects of the theft in California. But we figure about $40 billion went into these guys' pockets that wasn't their money, but yours. Okay? Now, one of these companies called Southern Company, and this is from Southern, this is a Southern Company account statement, which is from a very unusual place. It came out of the trunk of the car of the company's vice president for accounting. Now, this is a multi-billion-dollar international corporation power trader. I was kind of interested in this. This is before I was a journalist, and when I had a real job, and I was an investigator, okay, and working for the governments, doing racketeering cases for the federal, state, local governments, and for consumer goods and things. And looking at this, and what's interesting about it is that it says 100, it has a number at the bottom, its count number, $117,903,014.58 for charge to the public for parts for power plants, which didn't, whoops, these are $117 million for parts which didn't exist, okay? And they were kind of keeping track of things which didn't exist and did exist. I'm always interested about these accountants. When accountants steal, they have to keep accounts. It's really cool. You know, for investigators, like, it's fun. Now, there was a guy in the company named Jay Corton, senior vice president of one of their units, who was also in charge of making political campaign contributions, except in 1989, making political campaign contributions was against the law. See, because... See, we're talking about campaign reform now, but Franklin Roosevelt had a good idea for campaign reform. He said power companies like Enron and Southern, which give money to politicians, he said the proper amount is zero, and that's what was in the law for them under a law passed in 1934 under Roosevelt, because he said campaign contributions to companies like Enron, let's face it, are really just disguised bribes. And I don't know where FDR got off saying that, okay? But so Jake was making campaign contributions in brown envelopes and cash. And he didn't want to take the fall when some of this started leaking out. So he says, I'm going to go to the Attorney General. I'm going to tell him about the campaign contributions. And I might tell him about the Harry Potter bookkeeping that's going on in this company. And I don't think he could have used that phrase at that time. He caught me in anachronism. See, no one raised their hand. Something like that. Anyway, he told the company he's going to blow the whistle, borrow the company jet. April 10th, 1989, 10 minutes after the jet takes off, it explodes. Company tells me, or the CEO of the company, tells BBC, poor Jake, he saw no other way out. Okay. But the company saw a way out. They were indicted. Not for Jake's demise, but for cooking the books. But under the racketeering laws in the United States, even though the RICO laws, as they're called, which I work a lot with, the Justice Department has the right to quash a grand jury, the grand jury's move to indict someone under racketeering laws. So the Bush administration, Bush 1, Daddy Sr., quashed the indictment on the accounting because they said it may be a bit unusual keeping the account for the cars, two sets of books, phantom parts, but it was all approved by that upstanding accounting firm, Arthur Andersen. And they're shocked. Not that. Oh, they got rid of the, so then the company decided to go straight, stop breaking the law by changing the law. So now you can donate, you can, you don't have to follow account rules because there's something called the Uniform System of Accounts, which has now been thrown out the window. So, a company created by that, by the ending of the regulation of utilities and the ending of the accounting systems regulations, was a company called Global Crossing, for which George Bush Sr. received a $14 million in stock because he made one speech to them. He's a golden speaker, Daddy Bush. And no connections now. Oh, you know, it's interesting. Catherine Harris, One minor reform that came out of the Florida legislation said no more outside law firms to come up with lists of people. You know, you can't take away civil rights of people and involve an outside firm anyway. I mean, no more of this list making, Catherine. Work with the supervisors. So despite the new black letter law, Catherine Harris went out and hired a new firm to work on making new lists. Accenture, which is the alias of the old Arthur Anderson Consulting. Catherine. Here's a document, 199I, which means national security. It has a couple interesting names, suspected terrorist organization, Virginia Falls, Omar bin Laden, a couple bin Ladens. Well, I'll talk about that another time. Well, actually, the real question that was raised by Nancy is, what do we do? I mean, you laugh and then you go home and you think about it again, then you cry, right? Now you got. I think we can do better than that. I don't want your tears, okay? I do want your name. I want you to go to www.gregpalast.com, okay? And that's because we got to keep meeting like this. And we can do that electronic and virtually. We're creating a new community. People are getting the word out. So you start out with what Harry Truman said, tell the truth on them. Okay? You voter march. You join it. You support it. You buy the books. I can say that without shamelessly, because I'm not keeping any of the money from the books. What's made here will support the independent bookstores. The posters, please buy the posters, real book from Winston Smith, because they'll support these groups. And I'm not keeping a penny of the royalties on this book, because they'll go to investigative reporting, which is expensive, difficult, and for reporters a real dangerous business. I want to support the documentarians and people working on this stuff. More than anything is, I'm concerned about this phrase, move on. You know, I mean, what do they mean by move on? I mean, what do you move on from? What do you move on from democracy? You know, and they say, get over it. We've been on the other side, we've gotten over, and I don't really like what I see. I want to get back. I kind of like, you know, counting the votes and you know, the United States Constitution. I don't want to move on, and I want to get back. And in fact, for me, that actually has a very personal meaning. Very personal meaning for me and my kids, because I 2 weeks ago, my wife and I made the decision, and we just moved back permanently to the United States of America. And so, whether they like it or not, this is Greg Palast reporting from America. Thank you.
You've been listening to a talk by investigative journalist Greg Palast, author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. The talk was recorded last summer in Seattle by Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matters Radio. Now we turn to Mike again as he speaks with his guest Bev Harris about new information that suggests the possibility of widespread election fraud in America. Recollect from the speech that you just heard that now former Georgia Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney was one of the few voices in Congress aggressively pursuing the various corruption allegations with respect to the Bush administration. Remember the state of Georgia. You're about to hear a good deal more about their election process.
And we are very lucky to have with us Bev Harris, who is author of the upcoming book, Black Box Voting: Ballot Tampering in the 21st Century. Bev, let me ask you, how did you get motivated to write the book Black Box Voting?
Actually, I read someone else's article, and the title of the article was intriguing. It said, "Assume Crooks Are in Control." And the gist of the article was that we didn't know who it was that really owned our voting machine companies. And I have access and subscriptions to some databases, and I thought, well, I was on my lunch hour, I guess I'll just go look and find out who does own these companies. And within 30 minutes, I found answers that were very disturbing and needed to get some sunlight on them. And it kind of spun from there. I put something on my website, and kind of all heck broke loose.
So tell us quickly, who does own those companies? What are we looking at?
Well, the first one that I found, what concerned me was that we had Senator Chuck Hagel, who actually ran for office twice, while the only machines that counted his votes were the ones that were built and programmed by a company that he had ownership in and had been the CEO and chairman of.
That seems somewhat questionable. Was there... Did anybody look into that? Question about that?
Interesting. Well, I posted the information and I posted the documents on the site, and it took a while for the mainstream media to really pick up on the story, but they did in January this year. Again, some really dramatic things happened. We had a publication called The Hill from Washington, D.C. It's a very mainstream, nonpartisan congressional publication. Alex Bolton from The Hill decided to tackle it and see what he could find. In the course of his uncovering the story, or really verifying the documents that I had given him, the Senate Ethics Committee director resigned within an hour of meeting with Chuck Hagel. He had already spoken to Alex Bolton of The Hill and had said, this is the Senate Ethics director, had said that it looked like there were ethics violations here. Hagel's people came in and met with him. He then resigned, and they put a new spokesman in place who said, well, maybe there were no ethics violations, but there clearly were. You can really look at talk to any SEC attorney, and the problem is that Senator Hagel has ownership, had positions, and failed to disclose them, and it's not a gray area. It specifically says he has to disclose them.
Yeah, and especially connections like that. Now, isn't he a contender for a presidential race, potentially?
He has taken out the domain names Hagel2008.com and ChuckHagel2008.com, and he granted an interview with AP Wire Service indicating that he felt he was qualified to become a contender for the presidency in 2008.
Now, I know the writer at The Hill got some pressure about writing the article about that subject. Have you received any pressure from your coverage of it?
Yeah, I got a letter from ESNS, which is the company that Hagel's involved with, demanding that I take everything off my website or else. There hasn't been any follow-up from them to that yet. And the letter that they sent was actually quite ridiculous. It was saying, basically, I can report the facts, but if it puts them in a bad light, I need to take it off my website.
That would certainly shut down a lot of places. So moving along, there is recently, this last couple of weeks, you've been breaking multiple news stories about what I think is a really good example of what is wrong with our ballot system, and it happens in Georgia. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it happened in Georgia, and I've discovered that the same company, and actually the same weaknesses, it looks like, this company produces machines for 30 states and actually produces the machines for King County. But in Georgia, they have the entire state bought companies from Diebold Election Systems, which used to be Global Election Systems, and the machines are called AccuVote. And they bought these new machines that don't have a paper trail, the touch screen that you can't ever verify or audit the vote. The entire state bought the same type of machines. Well, it turns out that the programmers from Diebold Election Systems had been parking very sensitive files on a public website that anybody could go to. And these files were an open invitation to vote rigging, frankly. And they disturbingly included a file called Rob Georgia. Now, when we saw this file, because I actually found this site on Google, it had been reported to me by some whistleblowers, but I was looking for something else, walked right in the front door. There's this file called Rob Georgia, and I thought, well, is Rob a name or a verb? I'm not quite sure what this means. Inside the file that said Rob Georgia were files that said to replace the files in the vote counting program with these files and to run a program on Windows and replace it with these, which is what you'd call a patch. There's legitimate reasons to do a patch. The problem in this case is that nobody certified this patch and nobody ever looked at what was on the patch. And indeed, the patch was put on all 22,000 machines in Georgia without anybody ever looking at what the patch contained and did it have any malicious code. But it gets worse than that, because they were sending teams of technicians all around the state with these little cards that invoked a program. They were driving all over Georgia for a month, 20 different teams of technicians, and there appeared to be no security on who could make cards like this. Could they download files like Rob Georgia and stick them on the cards and put and reboot with those things? So nobody knew what was on it, and nobody really kept a real close chain of custody on who created it or if people could substitute it. And basically, nobody knew by the time of the election what programs were on those machines. It's a very serious situation.
So in your investigations, you ended up talking to a lot of people. What was Diebold's response to what you've just told us?
Diebold's response to the parking the sensitive company files on an open website is that they were never used for anything, which I thought was odd because there are something like 2,000 files parked there, and they've been using it for over 7 years. The most recent file was put there on January 16th this year. So if they're not using it, why are they there? And then they, Diebold didn't have any response, didn't claim any, claimed not to know anything about this Rob Georgia folder. I found another folder targeted to Georgia with very similar replacement files on it. And they simply, they admitted that they have been parking these files on this completely unprotected site, and they indicated that they have since decided to put some protection on it.
Well, good for them. But you started asking the state of Georgia and people involved in this, you know, why didn't any red flags pop up when these teams of 20 or 20 different teams start showing up and modifying these machines? What's the deal with that?
You know, what you find every time you ask questions in this state or in Georgia is they say, well, these machines have been tested and tested and tested again, and nothing could happen. So there were four levels of testing they said they went through, so I called someone, an official at each level of testing, and it turned out that the first level, they said, which was the state secretary of state's office, never looks at the code, so I guess it was just three testings, right? Well, the next level was an independent examiner from the state, a very nice gentleman. He said he didn't ever look at the code or test it because someone else did. And so I guess there was just two levels. So I contacted a lab called Wiley Laboratories, which was supposed to do the testing. And they said, well, they decided they didn't need to look at the patch because they didn't handle software certification. They had stopped doing that for voting machine companies in 1996. Now, that's interesting because companies like ES&S on their website list Wiley Laboratories as their certifier and say it's a very big company and that's why you can trust us. Well, Wiley Laboratories doesn't ever look at their software. They quit doing that in 1996. So the last company in the chain, we're not allowed to talk to them. It's a rule. The only person who is a guy who doesn't have any background in this type of programming, and he refused to answer my questions and hung up on me, so I obtained an actual lab report from this company. It's the only company now. We're down to one place that ever looked at this. The lab report indicates that they did not do a line-by-line testing. They never looked at the source code even originally. In fact, the program itself, the original program that went on the machines, apparently has not been examined by any human eye. The patch was never examined by anybody. It's stunning. This was admitted by people at every single level in the food chain, including the company and including the Secretary of State's Office of Georgia.
And when you, and as you pointed out, when you're asking these questions afterwards, after this has come to light, and they're just all blowing you off.
They first were taking my calls, and then when they realized that I was going to ask them about what... Now, what I'm simply asking is what security protections were in place to see that nobody could tamper, especially in view of the fact we have a folder called Rob Georgia that's on a public website, which contains the original source codes that anybody could download. And as soon as you get into any discussion of what security is in place, they say that we're not going to discuss the possibility of tampering. Now, if I make an ATM machine and I say to the bank, I'm not going to discuss whether anyone can break into this thing, they'll laugh me out of the office. Nobody's going to buy that ATM machine because it's part of the deal. Same thing with a slot machine. If the guy says, well, you know, tell me, you know, you're sure these can't be rigged, show me how you know they can't be rigged, And you say, well, I'm not going to talk about that. I mean, the response I'm getting from both the voting machine companies and the Secretary of State's office is they've taken the discussion of tampering off the table. Well, we have to know what the security is. That's our right as citizens. And it turns out when we really look at it that there is no security and that nobody has even looked carefully at the codes that actually run these machines.
And you bring up ATM machines. Doesn't Diebold produce ATM machines as well?
It does. Diebold is it just bought this election company, and so it's everybody talks about them as Diebold machines, but it actually was Global Election Systems, and they didn't change any of the management. It's the same machines. It's the same software that was used before. And in fact, they didn't even relocate any of the management. So there's this company over in Texas, and then there's Diebold in Ohio. Either Diebold is awfully lax, which I doubt because they do make ATM machines, or they are absolutely squirming right now. They've got to be just horrified when they see these kinds of security flaws.
So aren't there any entities out there that require that the source code has to be checked by human eyes? I mean, what do we fall back on here?
They keep coming back to one thing. They say logic and accuracy test. We do logic and accuracy test. What that means, in essence, it's called black box testing, by the way. It just simply means you run some pretend ballots through the machine, and if it counts those right, everything's good. There are a few other logic and accuracy tests they do, but they do not involve looking at the source code, which what we need to do is, and actually the programmers tell me it's even worse than that, because the source code can interact with video cards and it gets really complicated. The compiler itself can do things and it interacts with the operating system, the Windows system. So it needs to be somebody that looks at the entire system and how each component interacts, because at any level you could have malicious code inserted. But we don't ever do that anyway. What they do is they run these sample ballots through and call it good. And we know that doesn't work because I was able to uncover over 5 dozen examples of situations where the elections had been seriously miscounted. In many cases, the machines handed it over to the wrong candidate, and it wasn't a close race. In a couple of cases, I found it had 100% error. All the yeses registered as no, and all the noes registered as yes. We have places where 41,000 votes just get missed. Now, if a logic and accuracy test worked, even if it were working to see if they were accurate, it wouldn't work. I mean, obviously it's not working, but nobody who's a computer programmer thinks that you can do a logic and accuracy test to test for fraud or tampering. It's not possible. It doesn't test that.
Well, I know, having worked for a software company myself, that testing the code is pretty key. They put a lot of energy into that, as well as just having a feedback mechanism for once the product goes out to market. They have like extra people brought in to just for the problems that come in after something is being used.
Sure, because there's going to be bugs when you have a new software
system. That's just
a
given.
Yeah.
So, getting back to Diebold's situation, did you get a sense for how often these patches, like the one that they did in Georgia at the last minute, are happening to their systems?
It seems to be part of the deal. I talked to some people in Washington, and one of the election supervisors, a really nice lady, but she said that, well, we get a CD in the mail, doesn't have any instructions, and we're supposed to put it in the machine, and we run setup, and it overwrites the other program. And I said, well, so I called the Secretary of State's office in Washington, and I said, well, what controls do you have on these CDs that the election supervisors are getting in the mail and running on their computer with no instructions? And he said, it's not an issue. And all I could respond to that is, I don't understand why it's not an issue. Does anybody check these things? And he said, well, the manufacturer is supposed to tell us, and essentially here's the only control they have. If they hear about it, then they ask someone on the telephone what it does, and if it sounds pretty good, they don't ever look at it. Nobody looks at the code on these updates, and I think that has probably got to be the simplest way anybody could rig an entire state.
So it sounds like there's no checks at all, like let's say random drug searches. There's no checks at all that we have out there for just popping into any given state or county or city and looking at this stuff from time to time. I mean, you think after Florida, this might be on the radar. It might not be in the center of the radar, but it might be somewhere on it.
Well, now, there are a couple states. Washington's got one of the somewhat better laws in that you can, right after the election, a candidate can have a spot check done, and they can compare the paper trail with the count in up to three precincts per county. It's still not adequate, but it's much better than most states, which absolutely forbid people from looking at the paper trail, even when there's a recount. That is unfathomable. But they're really... it seems that we have sort of fallen into this system, and everybody tells us they're tested and tested and tested. Well, if you discover they're not actually tested at all in terms of a human eye looking at every line of code and the whole system to see how it integrates, then the whole system literally comes tumbling down. We don't have any way of knowing if our votes were counted the way we cast them.
I want to ask you a little bit about solutions for this, because I know that you've come across many good solutions. But I'm wondering about getting back to this lab. There's two big labs, I think, that were in
charge of. There's one lab that tests the hardware and firmware. And they do things like drop it off a truck or see if it works in the rain or whatever, you know. Or if you can leave it in the rain and it still works. The other lab tests the software. The software seems to have been kicked from lab to lab to lab. There was a lab in 92 that was set up to test it, and I talked to the owner of that lab. He said he actually pulled out of the business because, and it was ESNS that was the problem. He said they refused to allow him to really look at their code, and they would only allow him to do what's called the black box testing, which is sort of the you can't see what's inside, but just run a couple ballots through and see if it works. He said he couldn't put his name on it because he certified naval vessels and so forth, and he couldn't do the right type of testing. Then it went to Wiley Laboratories, and it went from Wiley, who decided that they refused to test it anymore after 1996. They didn't give a reason. Went from them to Nichols Research, and it went from them to PSINet, and it went from them to Metamore, and most recently it's gone to Cyber, C-I-B-E-R. Interestingly enough, all these different labs that it's kicked over to, it seems to be the same, I don't know, five guys or whatever, all in the same building in the same city. So it just seems like different companies come in and acquire it, and then they pass it off to the next company. There's another lab that has been certified to do the software testing, but I can't find any of the major companies that use them. So the key people we're looking at are called Wiley Laboratories, which doesn't look at the software, and a company called Cyber, which we're not allowed to talk to.
Okay. Now, the term black box testing is for the just seeing if it comes out with a count, right? And then white box testing, that is?
White box testing would be the looking at the source code and really getting in and making sure that the code itself doesn't have anything that would run a hidden program in the background, for example.
All right. And you said since 1996, these main players aren't looking at the source code anymore. Have they given a solid reason for that?
Actually, the only reason given by Wiley Laboratories is that the code became very, very cumbersome and difficult to test. They said it was, and this is for the optical scan machines, by the way, which are relatively simple. They just are a tabulation program. And they said that the code had made its way up to, it's something on the level of 900,000 lines of code for a simple optical scan machine. And so they said it was too hard and too cumbersome to do it anymore. That's the official reason. The programmers I talked to think it's ridiculous that an optical scan machine would have 900,000 lines of code in a simple tabulation program, and I don't know if that's true. That's the reason they gave.
And I assume there's fees paid for these people to do the testing.
Mm-hmm.
So how do they justify their getting these fees if they aren't really testing the code? I wonder.
This is the area that I think will be shaking out in the next couple of months, who is actually involved in certifying the certifiers, and who checks to see what's done, and what are the controls at that top level? Because that seems to be where it's falling apart. Well, it's falling apart all the way up the line, but the top level is where you got to go. The amazing thing is they pay fees to these companies. The public is not allowed to know what tests they do, but that being said, whistleblowers are emerging from a few different sources who have actually worked in the companies, in some cases worked in the labs themselves, and coming, and that's why we know that it apparently, although they won't say what they do or don't do, apparently the testing they do is limited to what's called pattern recognition, where they run a machine over the code, never look at it with their own eyes, and it just checks for certain patterns. And all you can do is load in a certain number of patterns and see if it, you know, finds those things. The number of ways that you can manipulate these codes to tamper with these things, it's not 10 ways or 20 ways. It's hundreds and hundreds of ways. Just go to McAfee.com and look at all the viruses that have ever been created in the last 10 years and put an incentive around that somebody might be willing to pay you $2 or $3 million to create such a thing. And you'll see that it's just not acceptable to say, we're just going to see if it checks this. Well, you can run your Word document. It might type some words in it. That doesn't mean that you don't have a virus running in the background.
Right. And I can tell you from my experience that the bulk of those viruses up on McAfee's site were actually written by people just doing it for fun.
Right.
So when that's amusement, you know, you got to really wonder about our voting systems. So what has been the response in Georgia about this?
Citizens are outraged. Now, the Secretary of State keeps saying it's not a problem because we did this logic and accuracy test. And one, the reason I keep bringing up this boring topic is that that is a talking point which is used, and it's going to be used again and again until the public just rejects it. Logic and accuracy test, LNA test, means you put some ballots through, see if it counts right. We already know they don't count right in many instances. You can't ever tell if they count right if there's no paper trail. It's not going to catch fraud. So, you know, taking that aside, the citizens are upset. One of the most interesting movements afoot that I've seen there, and I'm really watching this, how this plays out over the next couple of months, is some citizens got together and decided, well, you know, what can we do? It looks like what they're doing is rounding up people in all 159 counties to file individual lawsuits against their county commissioners. Therefore, the plaintiff and the defendant would be different in each case, and the lawsuit would be slightly different in each case. But they're rounding up a few attorneys who are volunteering to do this pro bono, by the way, who are developing sort of templates which can be adjusted for each individual case. Then they're looking at having at least 150 lawsuits filed essentially at the same time in all different localities under different jurisdictions by different people. So they can't all be dismissed at once. And most likely, not all the judges will look at it the same way. And when they do something like this, it's really going to force people to say, okay, we need to correct the system. We need to put the safeguards in place for the next time.
And what would you recommend to people here in King County? You told us the Diebold systems are used here, too.
Right. We use the ones that do have a paper trail. They're called AccuVote optical scan systems. We've had some significant problems, by the way. We had an election that had all kinds of strange things happening with the programming itself. I believe it was 1998, where, you know, votes were disappearing and appearing and things weren't adding up and they lost 14,000 votes here and so forth. So there were problems. But one of it's really four things. And the amazing thing is they're free and they're not very difficult to do. And so we really can't understand why there's any resistance at all to any of these things. And the great thing is you can say each one of them in a short sentence, and you can end each of the sentence with a three-letter word, duh. And the words would simply be, you know, the first one is, be able to look at a voter-verified paper audit trail. In other words, have ballots that the voter says, yep, this is what I did, and drops in a ballot box. It's fine to have it looked at by a machine, but have a voter-verified paper trail, duh. And the next one is, actually look at the trail to see if it matches the machine counts. Now, that's going to be the thing that is not done, because you'll find in almost all states, it's forbidden to look at that trail. It should be not only should it not be forbidden, it should be widely available to a number of different people, obviously with controls. For example, at any precinct, if they decide they want to look and see if it matches the machine counts, the election officials ought to be able to do so. Any citizen ought to be able to do so if he pays for it. And any candidate ought to be able to order it if he pays, the sample or a spot check for free. And you know, if there is a okay, so basically, we want to look at this paper trail. Duh. And the third thing is, if it discovers that there are errors, we need to disclose it and admit it. Again, these companies they know that they've had huge errors in many cases, and they attribute them to their own software programming errors, but they don't disclose it when they make sales presentations. And the fourth thing is, if the machines make a mistake, do something to correct it. I've found many instances where the machines have handed the race to the wrong candidate, they've discovered it, and they don't ever give the race back to the right candidate. And the other aspect of that is you find many situations where they found a whole bunch of machines that massively miscounted the race, and they don't go look at the machine. They'll say, oh, these 14 machines massively miscounted. Well, then look at the rest of the machines if you see that. So it's real simple. You just get a paper trail, look at the paper trail, disclose the errors, and correct the errors. By the way, I got an internal report from Diebold and ES&S, two of the big companies. Both of them right now have the capability to have all of their touchscreen machines print out a voter-verified paper trail. Now, my question is, then why aren't they?
Talking with Bev Harris, who is author of the upcoming book, Black Box Voting, Ballot Tampering in the 21st Century. And Bev, how can people find out more about your book? Where can they get it?
Go to blackboxvoting.com. And you also find all kinds of things. If you've seen something wrong, there's a whistleblower page where you can report it. There's pages for programmers where they can provide input on some of the different files that have been found and so forth. It's kind of a fun site. We were called site of the day from somebody or other.
Now, do you have an email list that people can plug into to get, like, updates? Or
Yeah. All they have to do is pop into the site and email the email that's on that page.
Mike McCormick, speaking with Bev Harris. So, to review, Jeb Bush was reelected as governor of Florida in 2002. His loyal aide, Katherine Harris, was elected to Congress in 2002 as well. Representative Cynthia McKinney of Georgia was not reelected, and an unelected president sits in the White House while his administration continues its assault on freedom. What is to be done? We'll close the program tonight with this essay by Ian Bull of the University of California, Berkeley, titled Neither Their War Nor Their Peace. Last week, at American insistence, the copy of Picasso's Guernica in the anteroom of the UN Security Council chamber was curtained over. Not an appropriate backdrop, it was explained, for official statements to the world media. We have no words for the horror to come, for the screams and carnage of the first days of battle, the fear and brutality of the long night of occupation that will follow, the truck bombs and slit throats and unstoppable cycle of revenge, the puppets in the palaces chattering about democracy, the exaltation of the anti-crusaders, Baghdad descending into the shambles of a new, more dreadful Beirut, and the inevitable retreat thousands of body bags later from the failed Mecca Jerusalem. We have no Olympian predictions. We do not know what happens next. We shall not ape the ludicrous certainty of the CIA hacks on the news trotting out tonight's excuses for 500,000 dead and wounded in a single laser-guided week. The best we can offer is negative wisdom, addressed to comrades in a dark and confusing time. The answer to war is not peace. War is the health of the state, as Randolph Bourne indelibly put it. But so is the so-called peace that the state stage manages for us. The peace of cemeteries, the peace of sanctions and containment, and the peace of the peace process, photo opportunities on the White House lawn plus gunships and bulldozers in Jenin. The decade of Iraqi deaths unseen on your TV screens. Neither their war nor their peace should be our slogan. It is time to make war on the warmongers, which means a struggle waged across long years, a campaign of attrition and demoralization. It matters greatly that already, before the war begins, millions of people are in the streets. But marching is no substitute for Mario Savio's call to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus. Don't mistake the elation of the stroll down Market Street for the painful, dangerous, month-by-month business of sapping the will of the political military machine. We know that its will can be broken. We know that a time can come when the customary ignoring of the ruled by the rulers becomes dysfunctional and leads the state to catastrophe. Vietnam is the word for that twilight of the gods. Cheney and Rumsfeld blurted out every night in the small hours and wake with their pacemakers knocking. Terror, too, is the health of the state. Underneath the absurdity of the duct tape and plastic sheeting advisories lies a serious policy, which our present leaders seem poised to pursue to the bitter end. The fomenting of a permanent culture of terror, sealing each of us into a pot of fear and isolation, and feeding our every movement into the Total Information Awareness Data Bank. We are already in a spiral where terror and the state embrace more tightly each day, and the target is us, our freedoms, our common resources, our possibilities of invention and ease. Don't put your faith in the blood-stained international community. Remember the UN's record through the years as hand-wringing frontman for any and every initiative of power. Remember Kofi Annan's role as chief blind eye to the Rwandan genocide. Don't think that Swiss banker Blix will fail to do his master's bidding in the end. Don't mistake the German government, which happily goes on hosting 100,000 American troops, for a real opponent of the U.S. Reich. The dogs will all want their share of the spoils. And even if, at the last minute, a nauseous diplomatic solution is cobbled together, have we any doubt who will go on paying the costs? The curtain could be rolled back again to reveal Guernica. The suits could make speeches congratulating themselves on the triumphs of military humanism. And still, the shit-smeared three-year-olds in the hospital beds in Baghdad would be writhing in agony under Blix's well-fed gaze, for such is the price of containment. Look through the mind-numbing speeches in the Security Council to the real pressure, the mass disaffection that is making the present pre-war scenario unlike any other. This is the real ground for optimism, we believe, limited optimism, in an otherwise nightmarish situation. The dreary ghost of public opinion, which the states of the world are normally so adept at conjuring and pretending to obey, has suddenly become a destabilizing factor in the final arrangements for war. Schroeder thought he could call the pacifist beast into the streets strictly in order to take the Reichstag and then retreat gracefully to the usual politics of, quote, meeting our international obligations, unquote. Blair thought the eternal British love affair with their finest hour would steer him past the familiar shoals of anti-Americanism. It has all turned out to be more difficult than Straw and Chirac ever dreamt. Let us keep up the crude pressure of refusal. Let us keep on setting the diplomatic lapdogs at each other's throats. This is a war for global capitalism, not for oil alone. The annals of oil are an uninterrupted chronicle of violence, genocide, and the cynical lawlessness of the corporate frontier. Iraq itself was born from this vile trinity. Now oil men parade the corridors of the White House. All five permanent members of the UN Security Council speak obediently for oil companies that have proved themselves specialists over the years in regime change whenever it suits their interests. Nobody, not even Bush, contests the fact that the U.S. industrial military machine is a hopeless oil junkie. War is inevitable, it is said, not because of American imperialism, but because of its addiction to the automobile. Dirty mobility is what America means by freedom. All of which is true. Petroleum is global capitalism's great lubricant, its key means of production. But the case is not proven that Iraqi oil specifically is a necessary part of the world picture. In hard cash terms, the Iraqi embargo matters little for corporate profits. Pay heed to the yearly reports and position papers churned out by Halliburton and Shell. What they truly covet is not sabotaged wells in the desert, but the deep water fields beneath the warm seas of the Bight of Benin, the Gulf of Mexico, and coastal Brazil. So let us not see in the slaughter of Iraqi civilians only the murderous logic of the SUV. It's not oil capital, but capital in general that we must confront. Look around as you march up the Boulevard of Shame. at the bland headquarters of Bechtel, Esprit, and Chevron. Which of the three has cleaner hands worldwide? To fixate on a single commodity and its detritus obscures the full horror and ruthlessness hidden by the word globalization. Primitive accumulation, predatory and profligate, careering forward on a planetary scale. In the destruction of Baghdad resides the logic of empire. Oil is a metaphor for something more lethal, more destructive. What is at stake is the true madness of the world market, the hubris of an imperial grand design intended to make the world safe once and for all, for capital. The map of the oil-rich Middle East will be redrawn, but that will only be the beginning. American internationalism reflects our national interests, a single sustainable model for national success. Such is the breathtaking monism of the new national security strategy. Is it any wonder that the costs of empire mount? More than half of all federal funds flow to the military. American bases metastasize across the planet, in 130 countries by last count and rising steadily. The homeland economy is bloated and debt-ridden. As for the miserable fantasy of the war as a blow struck in the name of the Iraqi people against their oppressor, the mercy by any means necessary thesis, the best we can do in the face of such looking-glass politics is to go back to Edmund Burke. Long ago he had this to say about the sudden discovery of human wickedness that regularly precedes an invasion. It is not with much credulity I listen to any when they speak evil of those whom they are going to plunder. I rather suspect that vices are feigned or exaggerated when profit is looked for in their punishment. An enemy is a bad witness. A robber is a worse. These are words for the times. The earth is crammed full of atrocities, and tyrants are always the true humanitarians. What matters on a march is speech, not speeches. The centrifuge of voices, rhythms, and banners, not the hectoring of stale celebrities. Least of all does it matter what CNN makes of the occasion. We recognize that, whether we like it or not, part of what's happening here is a numbers game, a counting of heads. But don't expect the stenographers of power to do anything else than traduce what you see. Trust your senses. A march, among other things, materializes the dead percentages in the polls and takes life for a moment off the flickering screen. It is a reminder, a fleeting and artificial one, but nonetheless welcome, of what the public realm should be. And that was Neither Their War, Their Peace, dated February 15th, 2003, by Ian Bull.
Now what if you got to choose which one of your hands you were gonna lose? And what if you had a say in which one of your eyes you were gonna have to give away? Then you might start to see the level of hypocrisy in what they keep selling me as a two-party democracy, where every couple of years they give us the chance to participate in this pacifying dance. Hold your nose and vote, yeah. Hold your nose and vote, yeah. Keep that file down in your throat as you hold your nose and vote. Now if you want parades, we got all day. And if you want TV, we got more shows than you could ever bear to see. But if you want what's right, yeah, if your appetite is for what is just, then I'm afraid tonight